Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. James Wiley will join us in just a moment, and it is as good as you think it's going to be. It was fascinating. It really was. And there are the study, although he hits a lot of the more than just the inner circle wives at the end of the book, we'll focus on pretty much like the six that were at the core of Hitler's inner circle and the role they played in Nazi Germany. Although a lot of them, well, I don't want to give away the ending yet. We'll hang on to that. Before I forget, congratulations to my friend Joe Brandmeier, who won an Emmy tonight. Also Frank Vassalero, his wife Amelia Sansaniello. These are old friends from the Twin Cities. They all won regional Emmys in the Midwestern region of for various categories. I won't go into it, but it's interesting because, you know, just like everything else, awards are all the pomp and circumstance of getting together and having these award ceremonies and everything's being done on Zoom. I'm assuming it was true for that too. It was true for some of the recent awards that my radio station was involved with here. And gosh, we just want to get back to normal, don't we all? And yet when you hear these numbers about, you know, not just the death toll that's on the rise, or the number of people who are infected and the rolling average infection rate, we just got to get through this period and turn it around. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you see this story I was reading, and it's just it just breaks your heart. The idea that there are, you know, they're using prisoners to move the bodies that are coming into these portable morgues. And this kind of thing is happening everywhere. And they've run out of room. And hospitals are at, you know, pushing capacity nationwide. So it's a good time to mention that we all want to get back to whatever or however as close as we can to our old normal, whatever that looks like. And we just, I think, have to be a little bit more patient to get through the holidays to try and get that infection rate down. We all have the power to do better. I hope we all do. All right. So that said, Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany, are any of them redeemable? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. James Wiley is the author, but he is also a screenwriter and a broadcaster in his own right. I'm assuming that was in England for the BBC.
Yes, for various TV companies and film companies in the UK. So I did spend a year at college in Long Beach.
Oh, did you really?
Screenwriting in the early 90s.
Oh, I love that. The author of the book Goering and Goering, or Goring and Goering, depending on how people pronounce it, The Time Traveler's Handbook, and Codebreakers, the secret intelligence unit that changed the course of the First World War. So thank you. The book is fun. I mean, as sad as it is, it's interesting because it's fun to read about a subject which, even if you are somebody like me who spent a lot of time looking at Hitler's henchmen from various aspects, these were new things to learn about them and about the women that supported these horrible people. And the women, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that the women are just as horrible as the guys. Nazi wives are just as horrible as the Nazis they loved. And many of them were, in fact, Nazis before their husbands were.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I selected the six that I did, partly obviously because their husbands were so important to the regime, but also I was interested in the women who got involved with Nazism before Hitler came to power. Because in a way, when Hitler came to power, I mean, obviously lots of people flocked to his standard, as it were, you know, you got in with the regime because they were in power. But to have made that choice earlier, when there was no guarantee that Hitler would succeed even, that I thought was an important criteria to use in terms of choosing the women that I wrote about.
And the way that you wrote about them, I thought was you were trying to be as fair as possible. But I just honestly, the more you read about them, and I'm assuming it's just as well for you on the other end, the more you research them, the more you realize these women, even if they never pulled a trigger themselves, they got away with murder in many cases at the end of World War II.
Yes, that's correct. And I think to me, the post-war story of those that did survive is almost more disturbing in some way than the story of, you know, of their lives during the regime and through the war. Because, of course, after the war, you know, there was an opportunity for them to have regrets or express sorrow or just apologize even.
Right.
You know, and you know, as you saw from the book, none of them really did.
And, right.
And a number of them were actually more like, well, you owe us an apology for being nasty about our husbands. And to me, in some way, that was more disturbing.
Well, and that was interesting, too, is how defensive they were of their husbands. And let's be very clear. When we talk about the men we'll get to, these are all very familiar names, you know, Goering, Goebbels, Himmler, Heydrich, Hess, Bormann. Those are the six main people that you focus on, although I like the fact that you also did some follow-ups on some of the other people in the wider circle toward the end. But in the case of those six men, these were not a healthy bunch. And I mean, they were in many cases physically sick, but also just mentally diseased in ways which it reflected the unusualness of their relationships with their wives. I'll ask the question this way, and then we'll get to more of this as we go along. But of the main six couples that you focus on in the book Nazi Wives, how many, James, would you say had normal sexual relations with their spouses?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, of course, normal is a...
Okay, but I mean, within the range...
Scale, isn't it?
But I mean...
But really none of them, in a sense.
Right.
I think, oddly enough, probably Hitler had the most regulation sex life of all.
Actually. Isn't that weird? I mean, that's like, because we always heard about, you know, Hitler and his self-imposed monasticism, and or because he had... You know, he had one testicle, that he was obsessed with his niece. I mean, all these other things that we know about Hitler. But you're right. In a way, he ends up looking like Mr. Missionary position before it's over, because and I know we'll get into that. But I mean, I think it's reflective of how screwed up this group was, that these women were willing, and they were. The women were not necessarily like that. They wanted normal, you know, sexual relationships with their husbands. Their husbands, these guys were, this was a screwed up bunch. And no wonder, in a way, they were such a collection of demented misfits. And it's reflected in the way in which they could even relate to women.
Yes, because they do sort of divide into either, you know, virgins, who seem to have, you know, they're just not interested in sex, or sex maniacs who just can't resist, you know,
any impulse,
any woman that passes them by. So, there's very little middle ground. I mean, strange enough, Himmler, in a way, ended up being more like a regular person, even though when he was young, he was very much the committed virgin. But, you know, in the end, he did have a middle-aged affair with his secretary, which, you know, I suppose you could call, you know, a relatively normal activity, certainly back in those days.
Well, it certainly comes off normal compared to Hess, and it wasn't...
Yeah, everybody comes out normal compared to Hess.
But I think, and the reason why I'm starting here is because, not to be salacious, but it's to point out that this wasn't because they were super religious. This wasn't because they had, you know, they were living up to a religious, like a Christian moral code, but because they were so weirdly obsessive about their destiny and these, you know, these sort of these mythical systems that they were trying to live by, and or that it comes right down to it, as many of them, I think, were just gay, and they were dealing with a latent homosexuality that they certainly couldn't express. But we know from the early movement of Hitler, what was attracting a lot of people to Hitler is that a lot of his early adherents were, in fact, there were pedophiles in the group. There were a lot of other there were people who were living closeted homosexual lifestyles that they were trying to keep away from their wives and certainly from Hitler, but in the end end up being kind of open secrets anyway. But I think that's where a lot of these guys, they fall into that same barrel.
Well, Hess served in the First World War, and the units that he served with, he was very much respected as a soldier. You know, when they went out, when they were on leave and they'd go to the local French villages, to the brothels or to chase women, Hess never took part. You know, and this is a young man fighting, you know, trench warfare. you know, his life is hanging on the line, but he showed no interest in pursuing women at all, which showed even before, you know, he's involved with Nazism, you know, he has some kind of aversion or block, or as you say, repressed.
There's something going on, and we can't ever know, as you point out in the book, he's a very well-studied guy, and no one's been able to quite unpack him, right?
Yeah, no, he's really a total enigma. And yeah, only Hess knew really what Hess was up to, and even then, I'm sure he had moments when he wasn't sure whether he was crazy or not crazy.
Okay, so let's with that as sort of a preface, and the kinds of things you do drill into, and it's really fascinating, the relationships, the nuts and bolts a little bit, if you pardon the expression, of the relationships that they have with their wives, and how frustrated the wives were, or the kind of place that they'd have to come to, it almost look upon the dysfunction of the romance, the dysfunction of the success of a marriage as some sort of noble sacrifice that they were making to the Reich. In supporting what they thought of as these great guys, and they're all basically criminals and losers. You know, even the smart one, even somebody like Goebbels, who was obviously, you know, an intellect, still had a million other issues going on. So let's start with Goering, because Hermann Goering was a World War I hero and somebody that all of Germany had looked up to, but he has his own issues, and that we then introduce us to the wife, the woman who's attracted, or the two women who are attracted to Hermann Goering.
Well, they're two completely polar opposite characters. His first wife, Karin, was a Swedish aristocrat who came from a family with far-right and very anti-Semitic views, who were very much into Aryan ideology and Nordic mythology. And she was a very intense, passionate woman. who was already married when she met Goering. But they fell madly in love, and he took her back to Germany, and that's when they met Hitler. And in some ways, Karin fell much harder for Hitler than Goering did. And she was definitely the one who really pushed him to get involved in the Nazi movement and to stay connected to the Nazi movement even after Goering had fallen from grace rather spectacularly after the Munich putsch, when he was injured and developed his morphine addiction and, you know, hit rock bottom.
Yeah, a pretty strong drug addiction for which he had to be treated in a mental hospital in a straitjacket.
That's correct, yes. Well, they said no more drugs, and he went nuts and attacked the staff, and so they put him in a straitjacket. But, I mean, he did kick it. I mean, at least, you know, for a while, he did kick the drugs, so he went full cold turkey.
Writhing around on the floor.
To support him and back him.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think he would have, who knows what would have happened to him, to be honest.
Where are you with the stories, with the collection of stories about Goering and being a cross-dresser and preferring makeup? And in your research, where did that come into it for you?
Well, he was colossally vain as a personality and colossally narcissistic. So there is a certain amount of that to it. His background was quite unusual, and he grew up in a very theatrical and colourful environment with a sort of godfather figure who owned various castles. So he grew up in these castles, and his godfather would, you know, act the lord of the manor. So there was a lot of dressing up and a lot of play acting. And then, you know, being part of the Richthofen's squadron during the First World War, that's the Red Baron squadron. Again, right. You know, these guys dressed up. They were very aware of their own sort of image. So I think there's part of him that he just liked display. He was a show-off, I think, in an old-fashioned term. So I don't think there's a sexual dimension to the dressing up and the makeup. I think the makeup was because I think he often looked very puffy and not very well. And he was trying to, you know, put on a good face, as it were.
But the eyeliner wouldn't necessarily account for the puffy face.
No. No. But again, it's that thing, isn't it, that, you know, there's no solid evidence
right
to suggest that, you know, that he had, you know, different inclinations, let's say.
Right. But still odd.
There was still odd. Yeah, well, I mean, this is a guy who collected, you know, pet lions and
right. Yeah, it just,
you know,
didn't.
This is a guy. Everything was done on sort of this extravagant Roman emperor kind of scale, you know.
But it would take a lot of woman, I think, to indulge a husband that was inclined to be a bit of a peacock and to always be the one kind of strutting about, especially somebody who, you know, was unstable in a lot of ways. And so Karin, his first wife, who he loses and then mourns for, really, for the rest of his life, even though he remarries, that woman played a central role in sort of building him up to Hitler. And so this is, again, we come back to the part of, do any of these women get to walk away and say, I had no idea what he was doing? She was buttressing him and pushing him into the spotlight because in a way, women in Hitler's Germany couldn't do it themselves. So the husbands had to take that role. But I think in some ways, it was sort of vicarious for Karen. We'll talk about the second wife, and then we'll hit all of the big ones tonight. We'll talk about Nazi wives. James Wiley, just getting started on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So James Wiley, we were talking about Hermann Göring, who was one of the six men that we focus on in the book, Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. In his case, he has two wives, and you study both of them. And as you said, Karen, his first wife, was much more of a Nazi than Göring was at the beginning. And then, rises to some level of prominence and understands his position, and even at the end thinks of himself as being the successor to Adolf Hitler. And Hitler didn't feel that way, but it was interesting how that played out. But then the second wife comes along because Karen dies, and he finds again once more somebody who is an active, not an absentee wife when it comes to the Nazi inner circle.
Yes, and of course she was a well-known actress. She always said she was not interested in politics and always claimed that she never really knew what was going on. But she, was extremely good at spending his money and extremely good at living the lifestyle of a kind of celebrity, really. And they did behave, very much like a kind of celebrity couple. And she, she loved, the massive houses and the yachts and the oil paintings.
That he was stealing from all over Europe.
Before the Second World War, he paid for most things, although he did use modern art, which they stole, as collateral in swaps and exchanges. So he'd exchange Picasso, say, for a Rubens. It's only really when the war begins that the wholesale theft starts.
Right. He got it. What we would call in America a five-finger discount.
He would grumble about the various dealers he used kind of overcharging him.
Yeah.
and taking advantage of him, of course.
Well, and so it goes for most narcissists, and is almost all,
yes,
I think all of these.
Someone else's fault.
It's everything somebody else's fault. And this is a group full of narcissists, not narcissist sociopaths. The worst kind, the weaponized kind of narcissists. And she was aware of what was going on. We know that his second wife was aware of what was going on because she used his influence in some cases to save people who otherwise would have suffered under the Third Reich.
Yeah, that's right. Being an actress in show business, she had an awful lot of Jewish friends and an awful lot of friends with left-wing opinions. And
communists.
When the crackdown began, she did, she did try and help who she could, whether it was trying to find them work or making it easier for them to leave Germany. She did her best. However, by the time you get into the war, Göring's power is in decline, and she can't really achieve very much at all in terms of helping her friends.
Well, why should we, as we examine all of the Nazi wives, why wouldn't we say, well, then she redeemed herself? She was the good one. She was the good Nazi in the bunch.
Well, the problem with that, of course, is, think of her is moral blindness. You choose to see what's convenient to see and ignore what's inconvenient. She did She wasn't a fanatic. She did her best where she could to help, you know, those in her friendship circle, you know, but she willfully blocked out the reality of what her husband was doing and what the regime was doing. And she was never able to admit that her husband might have behaved wrongly.
Yeah.
I mean, to her, he was always this wonderful man and this wonderful husband and father. And she couldn't really grasp, you know, what the problem was. So, you know, for that, even though, you know, she wasn't, you know, a full-blown Nazi. Yeah.
Right.
Still. Which I think it just shows that in the end, you know, when it comes to our own lives and our own story, we do tend to stick to the narrative that suits us best, don't we?
Yeah, and the narrative in this case that provided luxury. So if that meant having to, right? If that had meant having to block out all of the ugliness that she knew about, but she'd rather not think about, as long as it kept the money flowing and the servants paying attention to her, and you know,
yeah,
then.
Featured prominently in newspapers and magazines, and you know, she gets to live like a Hollywood star to a certain extent. You know, and she shows a kind of meanness of spirit after the war by trying to get various works of art back, you know, on the basis that somehow they'd been stolen from her.
Right.
You know,
right. These were rightfully hers because she had them for a period of
time. My picture, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if there was one of the wives, which I think has gotten some amount, maybe more than the others anyway, of attention because of the tragic ending of it all, and I say tragic not for her, but rather for their children, it would be for Magda Goebbels. The wife of chief propagandist Joseph Goebbels, but she's just as awful. I mean, there's just no, you can't look at her life and go, oh, I feel so sorry for the way your life ended, because she put herself on that, willfully put herself on that trajectory amongst all of the other wives as being openly anti-Semitic and openly, you know, cheering on Hitler to get away with as much as Hitler could get away with.
Yes, and in many ways she had, you know, the point at which she gets involved with the Nazi movement in 1930 is a woman who had an awful lot of options. You know, she was a young divorcee from a very wealthy, much older husband. So, her material life was secure. She could have lived in great comfort. She was very attractive to men. I mean, men were constantly falling, you know, madly in love with her. She could have had her pick of kind of Berlin society in terms of another husband if she wanted one or felt she needed one. So, in a sense, as a woman who really didn't need to go, you know, chasing the Nazi movement at all, yet, you know, once again, you see the Hitler effect. The impact he had on her was so great that she just, you know, committed completely and utterly to Nazism.
Well, and that she was a vibrant woman in that she had already had an affair with her while married to her first husband.
Yes.
She's smart enough to find a way to blackmail her first husband into making sure that even though she was the one cheating on him, that somehow she came out of it just fine, as you point out in the book. And then she sees Joseph Goebbels speak. And here's a guy who he is not rakishly handsome. He's cadaverous. He has a problem with a foot. He has one leg that's shorter than the other. He's not a playa, but she gets behind him because he's behind Hitler, and that's really where she wanted to be. And Hitler had kind of a thing for her from the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, the attraction between them was very strong. And he even, I mean, again, this is, Hitler never said it out loud, and this is according to people who were close to Hitler at the time. But, you know, after meeting Magda, she clearly made a huge impression on him, and he kept kind of bringing her up in conversation. And, you know, he allegedly floated this idea that he and her could have a relationship, but only in the context of her being married to someone else. And obviously Goebbels was the man for the job.
Right.
Because, you know, she had her doubts about Goebbels from very early on. I mean, you know, he was known to be a skirt chaser, as we say in England, and they were always fighting and rowing, and he was clearly extremely possessive and extremely jealous. So I think in normal circumstances, the affair would have fizzled out. But because Goebbels was the key to being close to Hitler, Magda was prepared to commit to him.
And just because there was a few to keep
bizarre,
track of.
You know, it's a very bizarre situation.
Yeah. And he was, Goebbels was a you know, a Hollywood Me Too guy.
He was a Weinstein of his era.
Right. And he was the one that was like trying to get his hand up Leni Riefenstahl's dress, right? I mean,
yeah.
The famous documentarian who, I mean, hardly innocent herself, but I mean, they're at a table, they're underneath the table, there's, you know, Goebbels unable to control himself, or, you know, feeling like he had a right to, or thinking that she would respond to it if he just went ahead and grabbed her by the crotch. And he's trying to, and she's stopping him from doing it. And again, it just comes down to is, this is not a normal bunch. This is, every one of these people are wet. And Magda, however, she comes with some children, and then they have children together, and they adopt some children, right? How many do they have in the end?
Together they have early in the morning.
Right. No, I understand.
Yeah, but she had a son from her first marriage, and then there's, yeah, it's six, I think.
Right. But, and so, again, not a, I mean, this was, and there
well,
was
what
this...
was very strange, I mean, what was, I mean, you know, when she had her first child with her first husband, she was incredibly sick. And it revealed a kind of long-standing heart problem. And the doctors warned her that if you have more children, you are going to be putting your life in danger. But such was her commitment to the Nazi ideal, or the obligation that women have as many children as possible, she kept having children. And every time she'd be sick, very ill in the run-up to giving birth, so she'd have to be in hospital before giving birth, and then she was always then in hospital for some time afterwards. And in fact, her first child with Goebbels, I mean, she nearly died. So it's a remarkable kind of, act of sort of self-destruction almost, to keep having these children.
Right.
Because it was very dangerous to her.
Well, and we'll save what happens to all of them a little bit later on next hour before we get to the phones. We'll run through, and so we'll leave in the middle. We're talking with James Wiley. Nazi Wives is the name of the book. So we're introducing them and that sort of the dynamics of those relationships, and then we'll talk how they end. And really, the most interesting pieces of all this is what happens in the middle anyway. So you'll enjoy reading the book. I won't be giving it, even though we'll be talking about their ending, we won't be giving away the book. Heinrich Himmler was a surprise to me. I knew very little about his life as a man, as a husband. And I guess he fits right into this group of misfits. The amount of prodding that some of these men needed to have any type of normal relationships with a woman.
Yeah, I mean, he was a bit of a mother's boy. Actually is quite a pattern with the men. You know, you get a very authoritarian father figure. You know, shows no emotion, no affection, very tough on his children. And then you get very doting mothers. So Hess had a very, very, you know, they all had very close relationships with their mothers, apart from Borman. And Himmler was no exception. I mean, she was still doing his washing for him when he was in his mid-20s. So,
right.
So there's that sort of dynamic with him slightly. But I think he was just terrified of women and sex and anything physical. And I think he always felt very insecure about his physique. You know,
because
he was always projecting the macho image.
Right.
You know, yet, you know, physically he was not exactly an athletic specimen.
He couldn't be further from the Aryan ideal. I mean, so far, none of them are.
No, none of them are doing very well on that front.
Right. And so they're very aware of this idea of the perfect German, and none of them are like that. And in his case, he looks like a Dick Tracy villain, you know, or he looks like a Batman villain or something. You know, he's not... And he is in the worst way, and yeah, where real people died. But here's a case where he hasn't. I mean, the talk about the woman who loved him and the work that she had in front of her to try and make it be it, even by appearances, a normal relationship.
Yeah, I mean, she was an old woman herself, and I think, you know, very emotionally closed, and, you know, struggles with human relationships generally. She really just wanted a husband who would, you know, be home every evening and look after her and provide for her and, you know, have a reasonably kind of quiet domestic life. And, of course, when she met Himmler, I mean, he was really just a sort of glorified Boy Scout, really, working for what was then a very tiny political party. So I don't think she had any sense or expectation, you know, that her life would be so completely overwhelmed by Nazism and his commitment to it.
But they had it in common. It wasn't that she...
She was definitely of the far right in her political thinking, and she was certainly an anti-Semite. And
right. This is what they bond over, is hatred for the Jews. I mean, exactly. Their pillow talk is how much they hate Jews together. I mean, the insanity of this. But that's just how it is.
You just realize how casual and how instinctive and how kind of normalized that kind of anti-Semitic thinking was.
You know, but in this...
it wasn't aberrant in a way. I mean, for a woman of her class and her background, wouldn't have been unusual to hold those sort of appalling views. It was just.
But she also didn't hold the line at "they're just my views." She was on board with the with the final solution. I mean, that's not the normal part, right?
No, that's she kept her counsel. I mean, she knew more, I think, than
right.
anyone did about what was going on. But she really never revealed her feelings about it. As you say, she never condemned it, and she had, after the war, the opportunity to do so, and she never did.
No.
I think she just thought that she bought into the notion that they were subhuman.
Yeah.
With Polish people and working class people. And
gypsies.
The way she wrote gypsies, I mean, the way she wrote about her servants, I mean, she was constantly... I think that's why some of the domestic stuff is interesting, isn't it? Because it's in those things that are very revealing of character.
It's the things that the non-public side of themselves. And James Wiley's done a great job. A lot of this comes from letters and diaries and recollections later in life, interviews. Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. I want to go back to Hitler, though, himself, coming up in just a minute. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.